Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome to the Psychovertical Podcast. I am your host, Andy Kirkpatrick. I wonder if you should change that. I mean, I'm the host. There's only me here, so... Anyway, it's me, Andy Kirkpatrick, hosting. What am I talking about this week? I'm going to do a Q&A. I'm sorry it's a bit late. I'm going to do a Q&A. I've got like a few questions that came in last week on my email, and I've got a few other... A few other things to talk about, like gear related. We just had this big storm here, storm bollocks, whatever it's called. Like, I really don't like the way they keep giving names to all these like moronochrome and all that kind of stuff. Like, I'm not keen on it to give it a personality. So true to form, like, you know, the island must have had like a million storms, but they're now sort of giving them these like colors, and it's like a red warning. So everything was, you know, schools have to close down, and everyone's terrified to allow, you know, to, you know, it's like, was it the Werner Herzog thing? You know, it's best to ask for forgiveness, not for permission, where now people just say, oh no, we're recommending that people, you know, shelter in place from this horrific storm. Because they're afraid they might get into trouble if someone like crashes into a tree or whatever. I think people are pretty good at not crashing into trees. Like, the number of people who crash into a tree is actually quite small. Most people, like, trees land on cars and that kills like one or two people. But I would have thought more people staying at home, you know, getting like electrocuted by toasters or something is probably more dangerous. But it was good. It was good, actually. I'm doing a talk for the Mayo Clinic, and I had to come up with a title. So I have been thinking quite a lot about this, about living in like a risk averse society and how dangerous it is. So I've my title's like Running with Scissors and like the danger of living in a safe world or something. Actually, funny. So Noah, who is now 1 year old, from the age of like 6 months, he could like climb up the stairs. But I've started like teaching him to climb back down the stairs, because there's a stair gate at the bottom, stair gate at the top. But ideally, you don't want him like trying to go down the stairs. Like, going up the stairs is dangerous enough by himself. But he doesn't go by himself, by the way. But he has gone up by himself, because there's sometimes a stair gate's been open and he's kind of got up there. So I've been teaching him allowing him to work out how to go down the stairs without any kind of help. Which is kind of handy, because recently I was looking after him, and we were upstairs together, and suddenly there was like, it was quiet. I was like, what's he doing? And I kind of ran round, and he was like about three steps down from the top of the stairs. So that's that. You know, if you live in like a risk averse world in which you don't let children anywhere near the stairs, then you probably end up with a child with a broken arm or worse, because they'll fall down the stairs. It's quite important to like immunize your kids against dangerous stuff, like against cars and dogs and trees, and you know getting them to be able to hold on a roundabout without having such a weak grip that they fall off and break their arm and stuff. So they don't get many broken bones with kids these days. So I sound like an old fart. So, but anyway, that's, yeah, risk is quite an important thing. So on the new on the on the on the news on the home front. So my son Ewan is now working at Super Value, which is the local supermarket, which is kind of cool. He's got his own aisle, dog food aisle, so he has to keep up on that. So it's been quite a rude awakening. He's basically been living in his bedroom for about 3 years, playing Xbox, and suddenly he's like having to get up early and go in there with his uniform on, and he's knackered basically because he usually goes to bed at like 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and he's suddenly, you know, man at work. So it's kind of been cool. It's been cool seeing him because he usually doesn't really eat any food because he doesn't expend. He's had the same trainers for about 4 years because he doesn't go anywhere, which is kind of weird. It's kind of weird that he's my son, but I do love him. And but he doesn't live with me. He lives in Sheffield. He would have had a hard life, I guess, if he lived with me. So so it's been interesting. Like he's been like eating like a horse. Like he's been eating like huge bowl of porridge, and he comes back for his lunch because only 10 minutes away. He comes back and he has like a massive whole baguette, and then he comes back and wants his tea. So it's been interesting. It's interesting that he was trying to get a job in Sheffield for months and months and months, couldn't get one, and he got one here in a day basically. So if there's any young British people out there, or not just British people, anyone, there's a lot of work in Ireland, It's not because in England everyone was saying like, oh, because of Brexit, we can't get anyone to work. But it's nothing to do with Brexit. It's to do with people just going home because of the pandemic and stuff, and they just decided to go back to Latvia or Poland or whatever. So anyway, there's lots of work here, lots of work in all sorts of places. So it's quite, and if you're a Brit, you can get a job in Ireland. You just get your it's the same. The Brexit didn't make any difference, so you could just come and get your PPE number, what it's called, and start working. So yeah, get off your ass and come to the what's it called? The something aisle, the green aisle? No, the emerald aisle, that's it. Anyway, so yes, that's cool. Anything else? Any other news? Any other I think that's it, I think. there's nothing happening. I've started watching Vanessa's been watching Better Call Saul. That's been our like evening entertainment. Post getting the baby to bed is going sitting downstairs watching Better Call Saul. Christmas tree's up. That's it. I've been rebuilding an Apple Mac. I think I said this on the last podcast. A 5.1, 5.1 if you're like a real Apple wanker. 5, not 0.1, not point. So that's been seems to be taking up way too much time. But I'm trying to on my ongoing sort of. You know, I've got to do a podcast this week, the Dalimpol podcast. Don't listen to it because it's probably me talking about COVID and conspiracy theories and stuff like good old days. yeah, James Dalimpol doing his podcast. But on my, I had this idea of saying to him about, you know, people are always talking about investing in gold or investing in silver or bitcoins, where I kind of think you should invest in like sanity and, you know, in logic and, you know, stuff like that. I have this thing about instinct. Like, I'm a total ignoramus. I don't know anything. Like, you'll be on a podcast like that and, you know, you'll have people like quoting Proust or something. I don't know. You know, the other day someone said to me, "Have you ever read The Road to Serfdom?" And I was like, "Oh, I don't like surfing." And that's a spell, by the way. That's quite a good spell. Good example of a spell. I've actually realised that a spell is actually just trolling. That suddenly came to me that's like you're basically trolling people when you say shit like that. I had this idea. It sounds like I'm a bit manic. I'm drinking some tea. Maybe it's gone to my head. But I had this idea about Justin Bieber. Have you listened to Justin Bieber singing "Fast Car"? Like, type in Justin Bieber "Fast Car." Is it "Fast Car" by Tracy Chapman? And anyway, listen to that. It made me think differently about Justin Bieber. And I was thinking about when Justin Bieber went to Anne Frank Museum, and he basically wrote in this visitor's book, like, "I'm sure she would have been a believer," or something. So maybe he was just like trolling us. And he went to the Sistine Chapel and he said, "Oh, I love the 16th Chapel. So maybe all these like Zoomer people, is he a Zoomer? I guess are all like fucking trolling us all the time, and we always feel so superior when really we're just being stupid, basically. So yeah, I've been listening to some interesting Zoomer people. I don't know what a Zoomer is, but someone who sounds young, and it's basically someone who's young but it's not fucking annoying. I reckon that's what a Zoomer is. And I've been listening to like a few podcasts by Zoomers, and it's been kind of interesting picking up the lingo. And I think they're actually going to be quite neo. I think they're going to be like neo-reactionary, which is seems to be reactionary, but sounds better. Reactionary. I think they're going to be into like Catholicism and, you know, Jesus Christ and all that kind of stuff, which should be it's probably better than the alternative. So better to believe in something. Anyway, so I should better begin. But just seen the nice guys over at what's it called? What's their podcast? YouTube channel. I'm just looking what it says. You know, how not to? You know the how not to YouTube channel, like how not to slackline and all that kind of stuff. They've just done like a piece on Down, which looks kind of cool, where they're doing some sort of hacks, like abseiling things. So that's kind of cool. I haven't been able to watch it because I find it too stressful watching stuff like that for some reason. I don't know. Back to my point was the reason I'm building a desktop is I'm going less mobile. I'm not going mobile. And trying to have a desktop in my house, which is in this office. Best thing about an office, it sounds like orifice, isn't it? Like I'm in my orifice. So I can't be like in this house with a laptop, as in sat watching telly with a laptop, sat having my breakfast with a laptop. So it's an extra, you know, string to my bow of like sanity is, you know, a dumb mobile phone and all that kind of stuff, no social media, blah blah blah. So it's it's working out quite well. I quite like coming here, and there's something old school about switching on a big massive silver box and it's starting up and stuff. And I was getting through about probably a laptop a year if you just, you know, if you're on it all the time. I guess it's like if you're a carpenter, you know, you probably break a drill every year or something, so a lot of laptops are more expensive. So I have been, you know, breaking a laptop every year, like various ways, driving a car over one, lots of like just spilling stuff on them, screens breaking and all that kind of stuff. So it's kind of expensive, but it is I don't have a lot of outgoings. For if you're a writer, it's really just your computer is the main outgoing. So yeah, so it's this Mac thingy is it's kind of interesting. It's interesting building. It's interesting being interesting in something that's not something toxic. Not that climbing's toxic, but like it's maybe that's another facet. If you're really gonna focus lots of your energy, you might as well focus on something that's actually gonna make you happy. Like get into like building model aeroplanes or something, rather than being interested in politics, because really it's kind of pointless. I think 2014 or something, I wrote this article, it's in my book, Unknown Pleasures, called Learned Helplessness, which at the time wasn't really a thing. I don't think many people knew what learned helplessness was, but for me, the gist of what I wrote was about how people become like numb. They become numb to everything around them. Like, you know, they just become apathetic, and you know, it's like, oh, you're eating asbestos. You're eating asbestos every day. You're gonna die. And they're like, oh, I don't really care. You know, or like, oh, there's a meteorite's gonna strike here in the, you know, in 24 hours, if you haven't need to build yourself a bomb shelter, oh, I'm not really bothered. You know, it's that kind of apathy. And it came from when, it's come from like the 1960s, some sort of psychiatrists, socialists, some scientists studied dogs where they gave them like electric shocks and things, and basically it's this thing where you just think there's no escape. So it's a bit like with the, you know, you can't go anywhere. Everywhere's got a mask mandate. Everywhere's got a, you know, blah blah blah. It's a similar kind of thing. Like they tried it on a, they had a guy, an Al Qaeda guy, where they basically put him in a coffin for 300 hours, and then they like waterboarded him for like 80 times or something. And you know, eventually you just get to the point where you just give up. Like it's not really a good state. If you want to break someone, that's what you do. So it's this idea of being so broken that you don't even want to escape anymore because you just think they're going to get you. So it's a very interesting, I don't know what the point is of that statement. But so an alternative to getting into like model making or you know, start playing, learn to play the guitar or something, or the penny whistle, is I had this idea. It's if you're gonna just engage with the world and all the shit that's going on, like in politics and everything else, if you're gonna read The Guardian every day and look at the BBC website every day, it's the equivalent of basically like being locked in a prison cell with some guy who rapes you every day, as a man, not as a woman. And basically, you can have this idea that maybe one day you'll escape or you'll be let free or something, or you know, you'll kill him or something. But really, those things aren't going to happen. So the only thing you can do is kind of start to tell yourself you're enjoying it, if that makes any sense. And I think that's kind of a weird, I think that's kind of how people kind of process a lot of shit, which is like intolerable and, you know, destruction of their freedom and everything else. They're like, actually, I quite like, you know, being locked in my house and stuff. So maybe I'm thinking more like this because we're going sort of, I feel like we're going backwards here in Ireland. So anyway, enough of that rubbish. Let's get on to these questions. I think the first one is about cam hooks. Question: is it okay to take lead falls on to bomber cam hooks? I can't see why not, but they only ever seem to be used for aid climbing. So if you don't know what a cam hook is, it's like a, if you imagine a flat piece of steel, which is probably the size of like a chisel. And it's kind of bent at 90 degrees or a bit more than 90 degrees, like 90-something degrees. And then what you do is it's got a hole in one end, in the long end, that long arm, you put cord through it, and you actually put it into a crack, into a narrow crack. At the time of crack, you would put a lost arrow in or something. And then when you stand on it, it kind of torques in, a bit like an ice axe. You put an ice axe blade in a crack, and you pull the shaft, it kind of locks itself into the cracks. So it works kind of the same way. I think if it was on a anyway. So you have like a few different sizes. You have like a micro, which most people don't use, and you have like a standard size, which is probably one of the more useful. And then you have a wide, which is wider, but it's also a little bit thinner, because it's got this kind of more metal there. And then you have an aluminium one, which is thick, but it's made out of aluminium, which is actually quite sticky because it's aluminium, but it's probably not as strong. And they're an amazing thing for aid climbing, because instead of like having to use pitons in the very, very thin cracks or trying to put in like RPs or really small wires, you can just whack in these things. So they really speed things up. Like there's a pitch on the pitch on Zodiac on El Cap, which is like an undercling where, you know, you put like cams in this undercling if you're going to free climb it, which you're not going to. And it's like a huge big like flake, and you could go across with like really small cams, and it's kind of probably quite scary, but kind of safe. You could put lots of pitons. There used to be lots of pitons on there, but they're all been taken out. But instead, you just go along on like two cam hooks. So you put one cam hook in, stand on it on your aiders, put the other one in, stand on that one, leapfrog the other one, stand on it, And you can go for, you know, like 20 meters without any gear, just on these, just on one Kamok at a time, which is actually fucking terrifying. Last time I did it, I actually had three Kamhooks. I had a Kamhook on a daisy chain, and I just kept moving that one along. So I always had like two pieces of gear in all the time. And then eventually you get to the end, you put some gear in, or you could like run the whole thing out. But yeah, the kind of cool thing. So for protection, you can take like daisy chain falls onto them. They are actually like very, very strong because they're made out of steel. And if you don't want to hammer in a peg, like potentially they could be as strong or stronger than a peg, but they, you know, because a peg, if you have like a parallel, say, vertical crack, is if when the force comes onto the peg, it can like rotate the peg around and the peg will just pop out. So you really want like a peg below like a bit of a constriction, so it tends to help like lock it in there. Ideally you want it in like a pod between, you know, in a slot between two constrictions, because then it like really keys in there. But the main problem with them is that if when you fall off, when you take your weight off them, they tend to fall out. So the classic aid move is where you get onto a cam hook and then you realize it's not actually very good, and it might pop out, like you can hear it, you know, being dodgy. But before you can step back onto the other one, it's like fallen out, or it kind of half falls out, and you stand back onto it and you're like, ah, in between the two cam hooks. So the main thing with them is probably to somehow lock them in place, which you could probably do by stacking them with something else. We could stack them with a piton, but you could jam like a nut behind one of them. You could probably set up some kind of system where you fall on both the nut that's stacked behind it and the cam hook. You could do all sorts of crazy stuff. Some people like put two cam hooks one against the other, like facing each other, and then kind of equalize, you know, the kind of equalize. That's kind of one technique. Or you could probably just use, if you got like a big bird beak, like a big pecker or something, a big talon. Is it a talon? No, a big tomahawk. You could like file it down so it's like short and stubby but thick, and that would probably work in very well in some placements. Hooks are amazing, like the bird beak kind of hook's fantastic. So yes, I have another question. Blah blah blah. This is from Ollie. On page 130 of Down, under heading The Test, you talk about testing 2mm cord. I can't get the 2mm cord to break by yanking on it. Do you mean just yank on it by hand? I cannot quite work out what you meant. Also, it did hold my weight, but even if the 2mm cord did break when I yanked, I don't see how that translates to a piece I can't yank, it holding mine and partner's weight. If you get time, that would be great to answer this question. So it's important to understand bounce testing. So bounce testing is where you apply your body weight, or more than your body weight, via a static kind of connector, which could be, well, you know, semi-static. It could be a daisy chain, a sling, you know, adjustable lanyard kind of thing. And you've got a piece of gear in. Say you're aid climbing. This is where it comes from. You know, you put like a really bad looking nut into a crack and it looks very, very dodgy. So you can either just like clip into it and stand on it and just start like yarding up on it. But you it could be like a time bomb. It might just like pop out and you'll just be terrified. And what you usually do is then you put another bad one in, and you just want to get on the one you're off. So you get onto that one and you're like terrified on that one as well. And you get another one bad and one in, and you get on that one. And so you just have this like string of like terrible gear that might all just fall out if you fall on it, but it generally doesn't, but that's how you feel. So bounce testing is a way of is establishing that piece is solid. Even if it looks terrible, if it'll take a bounce test, you know you're safe. So usually you put your wire in, you get your sling, your lanyard, whatever. You clip it into the wire, and you usually adjust it so you can like do like a, you can like squat down a little bit. So you do like, you know, you'll do like sometimes you can just do like one really hard bounce. So like really try, and it's a psychological thing in that you're trying to pull it out. You don't want to be wanting to pull it out. You want to pull it out. That's your job, is to pull the god thing, pull it out. You know, if you're like, please don't come out. Then you end up with like, you kind of half-assed do it, and then you're just wasting your time, because then you don't trust it either. You just wasted the time doing it, and you don't trust it as well. So you basically clip in, and you'd do it like five times, like one, really hard, two, a bit harder, four, you know, do it five times. And then if you really, really want to do it a few more times, if you really think it's terrible, you know, but really try and get it out. And eventually, like, shit, I can't get it out. I can't break it. You know, it must be good enough. So you get on it, and then you do the next one, and do it. That doing it like that means that eventually you'll look down a pitch with loads of really, really terrible gear, and you'd be like every piece of gear on that pitch was like absolutely bomber. So a good way to visualize this kind of technique, because it kind of gets more advanced, because sometimes you're having to do like bounce testing when you're standing really high on a piece of gear, or you might have to bounce test something that's out to the side, and there's all sorts of, you know, ways of doing it. Sometimes you might have to like climb right down, so you've actually got the top rope on the piece of gear on, and then you've extended your sling so you can, you know, it's very complicated eventually, but it's the simplest thing is you're trying to pull the thing out. So a good way of testing, good way of establishing in your brain how the bounce test works, is if you get like a piece of 2 millimeter cord, and you tie it into a loop, and you clip it into something, and then you just clip a sling into it. Now, if you stand on the 2 millimeter cord, I think 2 millimeter cord has got like 100 kilo breaking strain when it's knotted. So if you stand on it, it won't break. It'll just hold your weight. But if you then clip the sling into you, and you just give it like the slightest hard pull, it'll just break. Now, when you do it, you have to be very careful, because 2 millimeter cord is very thin, and when it breaks, if you've got your hand near it, it can actually cut into your finger. So wear some gloves when you're doing it. But so that tells you that if you have a piece of gear in, and you clip it in with your daisy chain or whatever, and you sit on it, and it holds your weight, that doesn't mean that it's not going to pull out once you start climbing on it. But if you like give it a one really hard bounce, like you could probably easily generate like twice your body weight. So a good way of you realize this is when you have a daisy chain, it's got the pockets. Each pocket is worth about 2 kilonewtons where they're sewn in. It's usually 4 kilonewtons because you usually have two bar tacks. And it's quite easy to break a bar tack on a daisy chain when you're really, really bounce testing really hard. So if you give like 5 really hard bounce tests to a piece of gear, you know that that will not only hold your weight and not come out when you're on it, but it also should hold your weight in a fall. So how this applies to... So the 2 millimeter cord is just a way for your brain to understand that when you bounce test it hard, that's going to be like at least twice your body weight. So when how this applies to abseiling is that if you're abseiling down some blank piece of rock and you get to, you know, like a single placement, you know, you got no backup. Like ideally, you know, you'd have a wire, and then you'd have a cam above it, and the cam is backing up the wire. So if the wire was to fail, you wouldn't die. But when you might get to a point where there's only one placement for one, you know, one nut or one, you know, one peg or something. So what you do when you're still on the abseil rope, you put the piece in as well as you can, and then you just bounce test it, and then you know that piece is going to be, you know, is going to be solid. So it's a really important technique. I don't know why more people don't know about it, but it is a total lifesaver, and it also applies for setting up really shitty belays. You know, you can bounce test all the pieces, you can like get three or four really bad, or 10 really bad placements, bounce test them all individually, so you know they're all kind of okay, and then you can equalize them all together and make like one really, really good placement. But it's worth, it is worth, as I say, like don't do it half-assed. Like you have to really want to, you want to be trying to do it. So yeah. So yeah, hopefully that answered the question. So the other thing I was going to talk about is there's been a few things going on at the moment with shunt problems where one person fell and the shunt completely came off the rope, and this is like appeared in on Mountain Project and various other places, and then there's apparently been like another accident with a shunt. Now, because I in and on my website, there's quite a few articles which mention self-lining with a shunt. So the person was like self-lining, so like top rope climbing with a shunt, and so I had a few people saying I should remove those articles because they're dangerous. And I think in the past, you know, the shunt was like a recommended device for that kind of thing, but now it's not anymore. So I had two like kindly people like emailing me about the Mountain Project on the forum that this was coming up and my name being mentioned, like probably my name and Dave McLeod, because we both probably mentioned about self-lining in the past. And one reason we've probably mentioned it is because there's very little information out there, and a lot of people will do their own kind of systems, and a lot of them are kind of dangerous, I would say. So I think Dave was using a Grigory as well, and he's been using a shunt, so I think he's actually taken down that material, but I haven't taken mine down yet, for various reasons. But I'm just going to read out my reply to, I was basically sent a reply to the same reply to people who like contacted me. So I'll read it and then I'll talk about my current thinking about it. So thanks for your email. Hello, this is another bad climbing accident and a close tragedy. Personally, I view it in the same way as an accident caused by a faulty Grigory or a breaking ski binding or a $1 billion stealth bomber crashing due to a faulty line of code, in brackets, or 7 billion doses of a vaccine that only lasts 3 months. In that everything fails, breaks, has inherent weakness in construction, design or concept, or fails to live up to expectations, or is unreasonable ideas around what safety actually means. If anybody followed the recommended solution for self-lining, which I think is now 2 microtractions, you'd still have accidents, even with redundancy built in, but different ones. I've been climbing since age 5 and worked in the climbing world for about 30 years and know of lots of accidents with shunts and the Grigory and harnesses and carabiners and ice axes and crampons and ropes. But this is the first time I've heard of total detachment from a rope with a shunt, which makes me ask if we know the whole story. Did the rope jam on the shunt in the middle mark and was the rope knotted as a backup above the shunt, not below? And then the climber climbed on and fell, taking a huge factor on the device. Something it, like Ascenders, was not designed for? ? The sad part of the story is that people will listen to the uninformed, in brackets, I never said the shunt was safe or recommended anyone self-line, but rather the opposite, that it's very dangerous and prone to accidents, and start using a single Petzl microtraction instead, which is 100 times more hazardous to use, and as the cam can easily be locked off the rope while climbing. This happened to me twice while lead soloing. Plus, it will chop a rope, not slip. I'd love to write this on a forum, but such places are not about informing or teaching or trying to be rational anymore. They are just gladiatorial dick-waving pits where a single accident allows others to score points, elevate their status by attacking people like me and Dave McLeod and others, or our gotcha moment, primarily by way of misrepresenting what we said, and in doing so, devaluing a lifetime's work in trying to make climbers safer, stronger, and better, and not dying stupid and unavoidable deaths. The end result is that neither me or Dave are qualified to speak. After all, we are where are our certs and certificates to back up what we write and say. Instead, the qualified will be asked an official response to such questions, which, being bureaucratic and ass covering, will always be "don't do it." Yes, this leads to a far safer world, one in which we're all protected from accidents, watched over by experts, every sharp edge padded, every stair protected by gates, every trip hazard marked. But that's also not a world in which climbers, bikers, base jumpers can live in. So we need to be careful what we wish for. Best, Andy. So was I being defensive? Maybe. Like, I think the point about the gree-gree is a good one, is that if you look at the number of fatalities and injuries and broken bones from people using gree-grees, that kind of, like, should you ban the gree-gree? Like, maybe we should ban belay devices, maybe we should ban ropes. You know, like, ropes are inherently dangerous in that, you know, they can be used incorrectly and not tied or in properly. Like, maybe they're too dangerous. The same with harnesses. People put harnesses on, they don't do the buckles up. You know, even harnesses. What about quick draws? You know, you had the famous case of someone where the quick draws weren't properly attached and the person died. Or what about carabiners? Like, carabiners can be incorrectly orientated and they can be opened and then break. And, you know, same with screw gates. If you don't use a screw gate properly, it could be hang up on the nose of the carabiner and, you know, pop off and you can fall to your death. And, you know, even rock boots, sometimes the rubber work gets sort of worn out and isn't as sticky as it used to be, and you can be, you know, climbing, standing on a hold you've stood on before, and it can just pop off and you can hit the deck. And, you know, even like every part of, like, the climbing, you know, the climbing sort of system you're using is dangerous. You know, helmets can disintegrate. And if you got the wrong kind of helmet on, it's not designed for falling down a snow slope and banging into loads and loads of rocks on the way down, and, you know, could disintegrate and you'll die. And, you know, you could have a helmet where the buckle doesn't release when it's under a lot of tension, and you know, head could get pulled off because it gets caught in some heavy machinery. You know, it's a dangerous fucking business, climbing. It really is. Like if you're trying to make it safer, then you're not going to do it, because it's not safe. It just isn't safe. It's like trying to make motorbiking safer. Yes, you can make it a bit safer, but inherently the safer you make it, the faster people go and kill themselves. Probably, I don't know what the rates are of people dying, but I think they're quite high. If you look at like wingsuits in base jumping, you know, were designed to allow people to be able to, like, track away from cliffs. So that, you know, probably the number way of dying at base jumping was jumping off and being very close to the cliff, and when the parachute opens the wrong way around and you crash into the cliff and die. So, you know, being a wingsuit was amazing. It allowed you to fly away from the cliff. So when the parachute opened, you know, you had, even if it were opened the wrong way around and you flew towards the cliff, you had enough time to be able to maneuver and turn around. So, but what people did, you know, they just used it to fly so close to the cliff that they could touch the cliff in the wingsuit. So it's like human nature. But saying that, the most important thing with all equipment is to be made aware of the dangers and the shortcomings, and to be able to filter out all the bullshit kind of stuff that people will say on forums and everything else. Like absolutists who are like, I would never do this, I would never do that, I would never use this. I would always use 15 Jumars all equalized, and I'd have like four ropes. And, you know, like, the reason why the shunt is kind of has always been popular is it's quite a cheap device, and you can use it on like one or two ropes, and it doesn't require a huge amount of skill or you know, understanding, and it kind of goes up both up and down the rope to some degree, where if you use a crawl or something, or a Jumar, it only goes up a rope. So if you're traversing, if you go up and then traverse and go up, like, basically you can't do it because the rope is too tight. So then you end up trying to fiddle with the cam, and it gets stuck on the rope, and then before you know it, you've taken the cam off the rope, and now you're totally free soloing. And so there are better devices than the shunt, but they're probably cost, you know, five times as much, and a lot of climbers are going to buy them. And even those, like the what's it called, the kind of rope access kind of gadget that people use at the moment, is even that one is like, it's very easy. I've seen people with what I saw someone with one, and he actually had it on upside down, you know. So you're not going to get a shunt upside down, hopefully, because it's got like a little man pointing. But you know, you end up with this solution that's supposed to be like much, much safer. But in my mind, it's not. It's kind of more dangerous. It's more, you know, in order to try and make something that which is way safer, you end up making something that requires a far higher degree of, you know, of skill and understanding and everything else. And you know, you might end up getting the best rope soloing, top rope self-lining device known to man, which is probably going to be something like a Petzl micro ascender, or what it's called, rescue ascender, something like that. And what happens is you end up like your rope breaks because you didn't protect the edge, or you pull down a big rock, you know, rock comes off at the top of the crag because the rope goes over it or something. So it's just dangerous, basically. All these things are dangerous. But just go back, like, your man who does a lot of videos on this subject, is your man, what's his name? Let's find it. That's his name. Is Jan. Jan Camus. Is it Camus? Camus? And I think I've had quite a few, we've had quite a few emails together, and I think he lives in Quebec. And, you know, there's a lot of really good videos, like a lot of really good content. So Jan, like, originally emailed me about this problem about, and that I should remove the information on my website. And again, like, maybe I was defensive, but I don't think it's a good idea to, I think it's a good idea to like include his video about the issue. But it's a, you know, it's like a device that's kind of on the market, and you know, people have been using it for like maybe 40 years, like a shunt in this kind of way. And yes, there's been lots of accidents with a shunt. This is the first one I've ever heard of where the shunt actually came off the rope. And he's kind of, so anyway, he's got a video. It's called Top Rope Solo with a Shunt Can Kill You, the Scorpion Catch, which I highly recommend you check out. I'll put it in the, I'll put a link in the notes of the podcast. But it's worth seeing it and trying to understand how it would happen. Is like, generally most equipment failure comes down to like pilot error, like you didn't have it set up properly, you didn't, you know, like the way the device fails is you know, it's kind of, it'd be possible for it to happen, but not if you've got your rope set up properly. You know, maybe if you're, I don't know, you could probably, I think it'd be quite hard to recreate it, and you'd have to have, I would have thought you'd have to be using like quite a thin rope, like a, you know, sub 10 millimeter rope, which I wouldn't recommend for self-lining. Like, I'd always think you should have like a 10 or 11 mil, like static, you know, thick static rope for self-lining, ideally. So being aware of the problem, is maybe that'll make you go out and get another device, you know, like that might be, you know, where the rope 100% can't escape from the device, and you know, like tying backups in the rope is gonna save you. But ultimately, the whole business of self-lining is just very, very dangerous in lots of ways. Just moving around on top of a crag is kind of dangerous. So yeah, my wife is shouting at me. Right, that's that sorted out. my son was back for his lunch. So it's a tricky one though, because I'm always aware that I am often writing about stuff that is, what's the Necronomicon? Like, it's kind of forbidden information, really. So you're trying to inform people about things that, if they're not informed about, could kill them, especially if they just try and make it for themselves. Like, I used to be on the rope soloing Facebook group. I had to leave because I just found it too terrifying, the stuff that people were, and it's like a full-time job, just every day, like on Facebook saying, like, don't do this, you're going to kill yourself. Like, that's just not a safe thing to do. And of course, people were like, what do you know? What do you know about rope soloing and that kind of stuff? Or you sound like you think you know more than other people. It's like, well, I did write a book about it. And I have sold the El Cap lots of times. So anyway, so it's a bit like that. And the forums are the same. Like, if you go on the forums, it's just, I don't know. It's just very hard to, before you know it, people will be like, oh, you're alt-right or whatever. Why should we listen to you? You're a racist. You're alt-right or something. And, I just can't be arsed with all that kind of stuff anymore. So I just don't bother. So, you just have to put it out there. Like, luckily, like, I'm sure people might read things that I've written and they might get killed because they kind of don't really understand them, or they don't understand that when I say that something's dangerous and you shouldn't do it, as in there's a disclaimer saying rope soloing is like really, really dangerous, you shouldn't do it, they probably don't take that seriously. But that is like, people do die. Well, look, people do die rope soloing, but people also die, more people die self-lining because it's more common. I don't know if I said on this podcast, but I went to Dorky Quarry during lockdown, which is like the quarry in Dublin. I just saw so many absolute fucking spine-tinglingly terrible things going on there with people. I saw someone where the guy's son was belaying him, and literally he was like pulling the rope through the belay device with both hands on the kind of, the dead side of, is it the live side of the rope? I always get confused. Anyway, the rope where if you fell off, you wouldn't be doing any good whatsoever. You're just like pulling it up with two hands through this belay device, as if he maybe assumed that, a belay device would just lock off automatically, but it wouldn't. It was just like a tube belay device. And so that was like terrifying. I literally had to go up to him and say, like, excuse me, like, I need to ask, like, do you know how to, you'd have to hold on to that other side of the rope, like the dead rope. Otherwise your dad's going to die if he falls off. And the dad was like, oh, I was like, oh, Christ almighty. Like, can imagine if your dad didn't teach you to belay properly and he falls off and kills himself, or worse, ends up like paraplegic or something for the rest of his life, and you have to look after him and wipe his arse and all that kind of stuff. Like, imagine what that would be like, that for both parties. It's like, it's serious stuff, basically. And then I went round to the corner and there was a guy belaying his son, like as in a small child. He was belaying his son and he had a belay device with a locker on it, and then he had a quick draw clipped from the locker into his belay loop on his harness, so it's kind of extending it out. And I was just like, what the fuck? And then the rope was going up, and then he just had quick draws. He had a quick draw rather than a screw gate, and then back down. I didn't even go and look at what his anchor was tied to. I hate to imagine. But again, I had to come up to him and I was like, I did this thing where I say, like, oh, like, basically, if there was an accident and one of them got killed and I'm standing right next to them, like, I am kind of legally responsible because I am the most experienced person there. And someone could be like, why didn't you say something? You were involved in this accident. And there is some kind of comeback. So I kind of I kind of went up to him and was like, oh, sorry, I don't want to be a dick about it, but you know, that's not safe. What are you doing there? And he was, you know, he was like, why not? And I'm, you know, it's very, if you can't see why something's not safe, it's like, excuse me, I saw you about to stick your dick in that grinder over there. And I just need to point out that if you stick your dick in there, like, it's going to get ground off. It's like, why, what's wrong with, you know, maybe he wanted to kill his son. I don't know. But it is a very different, difficult thing, because it's like, oh, you act like you know something I don't, a kind of thing. And it's like, no, it's not that I know something you don't, but you don't know fucking anything. If you know, like, it's like weird to see it twice in the same day. And just you know, you're always the aim when you're setting up a Beely or trying to make a system is to make it as safe as possible. Not to do the minimum amount required to make it safe. You've got to make it as safe as possible. So if you're setting up a top rope anchor, you know, someone might look at my top rope anchor and they'd be like, why have you've tied it to that metal stake, which most people might just trust that by itself. And then you've got it going over to that tree. And then when it goes over the edge, you've got it attached to a cam and a nut or something. And you're like, well, yeah, it's four pieces of gear. But basically, that stake has been there since, like, the 18th century, when this was a quarry and they were working it. Like, it might look nice and shiny, you know, and metally at the top, but you don't know how deep it is. It could be completely corroded, and like millions of people top rope off it. Like, one of these days it's going to break. And then where the rope is tied to, that's not a tree. That's a bush over there. And everyone ties the ropes to that bush, and the bush is basically dead, and the root is just a root of the bush, and so it's only tied to that. So neither of these two things in my book are actually safe. So, and here is, you know, the two bits of gear actually on the face of the climb are actually the two safest pieces of gear. They're not like, you know, they're not like a backup, really. The other things are the backup. And, you know, those two pieces of gear also position the rope where the climb is. So, like, if someone falls, you know, climbs sideways and they fall, the force is on those two pieces of gear. It's not on that one bush, which is then going to rip out. And then the rope is going to cheese grate across the top of the crag as it weights the other thing, which is probably going to break anyway if you take that kind of fall. So it's just, but you do see so many people, it's almost like, oh, you're a bit safe. You know, you're a bit of a safety person, aren't you? I can see you've put like three bits of gear in there when, you know, none would suffice. So it's not about being, it's not a sign of like of mastery is to be dangerous. It's the opposite way around. And I always tell this story about climbing with Andy Parkin, who's kind of a legendary, you know, ice climber, like mountaineer. And we went to this route called Shivalingam, which is like a grade 6 ice route back in the day when that was, when grade 6 was proper hard. And we soloed the first pitch, and then I led the second pitch, and he led the last pitch, which is probably the hardest pitch. And he was going up, and I just had this idea that he would just like run out the whole thing, because he was this like hard man. Like Andy Parkin, basically one of his arms is fused, so he can just like hang on it all day long. And it's like fused at 45 degrees, so he can just like hang on an ice axe. Anyway, but he climbs up, and he kind of, first of all, I think he whacked in like a peg, like into the rock, and then clipped the rope into that. Then he went a bit higher. Then he kind of got his leg sort of wrapped around this boss of ice. Then he put like two ice screws in and like equalized them and clipped the rope into that. And he just like laced up this route. And I was just like, and it was like a really good thing of like, that is what being a good climber is about. It's not about, you know, running it out, you know, and eventually one day falling off and dying. It's money in the bank, basically. It's just about putting in the time, putting in the gear, getting good at putting gear in. You know, like Mick Fowler, they always said about Mick Fowler, like he could find gear anywhere. And I think someone told me that, and I always try to do the same. Like I can be, somewhere where it looks like it's absolutely nothing going in and I can find some gear. Like that's one of my key skills, is be able to find gear, like dig down into the ice or into the muck or into the, you know, smack rock, break rock out of cracks and find a, you know, create a, you know, not manufacture replacement, but you've got, you know, on some crags, the cracks are full of muck and dirt and you can like whack, you know, my nut tools are always like completely worn down because I've, you know, scraped so much crap out of cracks and stuff. But, you know, and then having the right gear so you can, you know, you can like exploit those kind of things. So in the past, that would be having like baird beaks when no one even knew what baird beak was. You know, you're going to do routes, you know, on Ben Nevis and stuff, and you'd be able to find like get really good gear with that kind of gear, where before people would have, you know, some warthogs and a Moak and whatever. But you know, it is about like finding that, being able to find the gear and making it safe, or building a belayer and making it safe. It's not about, it was so cool, like he didn't even have a belayer, and you know, that's just not really, it's not really acceptable, really. You know, like there are times in your life when you're not going to have a belayer, but don't make those times the times when you could have a belayer. You know, they really, you know, really save those times up, because they don't happen very often in your life when there is no belay whatsoever. There's always something. So, so I think it is a tricky one. What I'm going to do, I'm going to go on my website. I'm going to add Jan's video to any posts I've got, and I'm thinking I'm going to redo Me, Myself, and I. I'm going to do like the third edition, and I think I'm just going to remove all the self-lining stuff out of it, because it's just too tricky thing, and I don't want people, you know, like people could die and sue me, but I don't really have any, I'm not really worth suing. That's why, like when Jim Bridwell was sued, they didn't sue him, they sued like Black Diamond, because basically Jim Bridwell didn't have anything worth having. So, you know, that's not really a very good defense. Like I set out to do the things I do, not to make money off climbers. I set out to do it in order to make climbers safer. You know, like the down book, and even the Me, Myself, and I, and the Higher Education, all those books are not about me making loads and loads of money, because there are easier ways, probably, of like working in a supermarket is probably a better way of making money. But I genuinely have always felt in service to climbers, really, even though I'm not appreciated sometimes. You know, I have always felt like that is my tribe, and that is the people, you know, I'm not responsible for them, but I am responsible to try and communicate to non-climbers what climbing's about, what climbers are about, and people who do like risky shit, but also to try and make it less risky and less dangerous, and you know, and that kind of thing. I really appreciate like Jan, and I probably would appreciate people on the on the forums who are trying to do the same sort of thing. But you just have to be careful not to end up doing something that's even more dangerous. And I would say like the micro tractions and things are actually more dangerous in the end. You know, they're not really, if you got like two of them on the rope, you know, they're probably safe enough, but I think there's something to be said for the shunt, and there's something to be said for all of them, but all of them have, you know, drawbacks and dangers and things. That's me talking for an hour. I probably have some more questions, but I can't be asked looking for them. I need to make my tea. I'm trying to learn to make food, to make decent food that's kind of recession, good for inflation, good for, you know, when everything costs like 10 times as much as it used to. So I'm making goulash tonight. And basically, you need to look at what people eat, like what poor people eat. Poor people who haven't got access to much food. That's the kind of food you need to look at making.
So yeah, I'm making goulash. I don't know if you've ever, is it borscht? Like borscht soup, like Russian sort of Eastern European beetroot soup. That's another good one to have. That's a very good one. Corned beef hash, that's a good one. Yeah, you have to just get a can, some cans of corned beef. Very, very good. You can make that, and it just potatoes, carrots, onions, corned beef, a bit of stock, bang it in a big pan. That's good. That's that way I grew up eating corned beef hash. So yeah, anything, get one of those tortilla presses. I haven't got one, but you know, make your own tortillas, yeah, rice and beans and all that kind of stuff. That's good, good food for high food prices, you know. So I don't think people have to worry too much. Maybe I'm being typically paranoid about this kind of stuff, but that's the real world. You have to think about these things, what to do. There's three people making money in this house now, so it's not so bad. I'm not like an old person trying to live off a pension. That'd be worse. Although there's always suicide. So I shall, on that cheery note, I shall leave you. So I'll put in the link to Jan's video and also the video from the How Not To guys about, you can watch it, tell me what you think. And I shall try and do a podcast. I was going to put my last gig on here, but I don't know if the quality is good enough, because I just have to put the tape recorder like on the side of the stage, and it's a bit crap. So I'll see if I can clean it up. But if not, it's good. It's always good to keep a reference of these things myself, because you have lots of things you say and you just forget next time you do them. So yeah. Okay. Until next time. See you soon.
Credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.